Welcome to Virtual Machines Class 3. So last lecture, we talked quite a bit about our hypervisors. So again, we defined two different types of hypervisors. The type 1 hypervisor that we install directly on top of the hardware and has direct control of it. And we also talked about the type 2 hypervisors, which we install within our operating systems and have to ask permission of the operating system in order to access the hardware. Of course, type 1 hypervisors are a lot faster, a lot more secure because there isn't that interaction with the operating system. But type 2 hypervisors are a lot more flexible. So within our Windows environment, we can install a number of different type 2 hypervisors and use them interchangeably. Remember, type 1 hypervisors have direct access to layer 0 or kernel 0 of the x86 architecture, meaning that they communicate directly to the hardware, where type 2 hypervisors only have access to layer 3. Layer 3 is that application layer. So again, they have to ask permission from the operating system in order to perform any actions on the hardware. We also defined two different types. We defined monolithic and microkernelized. So the monolithic design, similar to what VMware does, is that it only relies on the drivers that are installed within the hypervisor. So if we're going to do a driver update on any of our hardware, we have to do it within VMware in order to get our guest operating systems to recognize it. In the microkernelized design, which is the Xen design or the Microsoft Hyper-V design, you can actually install device-specific drivers within the guest operating system, and they can work independent of the hypervisor. Again, in order to access the hardware directly, they have to talk through the hypervisor, so it's not that the hypervisor is not involved, but they have more control over the feature set. Also be aware, again, it's kind of tricky. When we in the lab installed Microsoft Hyper-V, we installed Server 2012 first and then added the Hyper-V role. Even though the Hyper-V role is built within Server 2012 R2, Microsoft Hyper-V is still a Type 1 hypervisor because the Type 1 hypervisors have direct contact to the hardware, and that Hyper-V does have. So Hyper-V is a Type 1 hypervisor, not a Type 2 hypervisor. So in Chapter 3, we start talking about our guest operating systems and what those virtual machines really are. So we're going to talk about what comprises a virtual machine, the resources that appear in it, how requests move from the virtual machine through the hypervisor and back again. And then at the end of this chapter, we talk about the open virtualization format. Again, our second paper deals with the open virtualization format, so we're going to do a little bit more than the book does in regards to talking about the OVF format. So intrinsically, what is a virtual machine? A virtual machine is just a set of data files on disk. So when we copy virtual machines, when we download virtual machines, we're just downloading files. In terms of a programming language, it's an instantiation of the container that runs an application. So when we create a virtual machine, we're making a workspace that's going to store the information that actually lets our guest operating systems run within the virtualized environment. Again, there's no hardware involved. It's storage on disk. Later on, when we talk about disk storage, we talk about the types of different disk storage that we can use to make our machines faster. But again, it's just a file on disk. So virtual machines use virtual hardware. Really, from the virtual machine perspective, it is a physical server. The virtual machine should not know that it's a virtual machine. Again, that goes back to our properties on what makes an efficient virtual machine. And again, those properties are important to know, so make sure you review those and have a good understanding of those. Virtualization approaches each resource differently, so we'll see some different options that we have with our physical hardware. And again, we're starting with a 40,000-foot overview. Later on in some of the further chapters, we'll do more of a deep dive and talk about more of the things that we can configure and deal with at that point. So the first thing that we talk about is virtual CPUs. So virtual CPUs, or vCPUs, are slices on physical CPUs, or pCPUs. So really, when we talk physical CPUs, we talk slices of time. So I go back to the analogy. Whenever somebody asks me, are you good at multitasking? Really, there is no such thing as multitasking. You can't work on more than one task at a time. So the technical term for that is time division multiplexing. And I love to throw that out there. It's one of those big words that sounds like it's really deep meaning, but it really what it is slices of time. So when we had our single core CPUs, what they did is they sliced up time. So again, we'd start these processes within our Windows system or within our Linux system. Within Linux, you can see the running processes by typing ps. Within Windows, you can open up the task manager and see the running processes. And each of those are trying to vie for time on the CPU. So the CPU has to be intelligent enough to divide up its time between those different processes in such a way that it makes it appear that all of those processes are running simultaneously. Really, they're not. Again, time division multiplexing, they're getting a slice of time and then it's moving on to the next process. So in terms of vCPU, vCPUs again are just slices on the physical CPU. So our CPUs have become really good at splitting up that time, dividing times up. Again, we've gone from that single core processing unit to multi-core processors. So we talk two different types of processors. We talk slots and we talk cores. So when we talk slots or sockets, those are the actual places that we can plug our physical CPUs into. So back when we used to have dual core PCUs, we used to have actually two sockets and we'd have two separate single core CPUs. And then somebody said, why are we putting two separate CPU units in the machine when we can actually integrate them on a single chip and put two processors on one chip and have it divide the time that way? So then we deal with our cores. So if I have a quad core or an eight core machine, I actually have four CPUs on one chip or eight CPUs on one chip that goes into one socket. Now we still have multiple socket CPUs as well, so we can say we have two sockets and eight cores. So if each socket has eight cores, then we have two times eight, which is 16. So we have 16 physical CPUs that we can assign to. Now again, when we talked virtualization, we talked our consolidation ratio. With the consolidation ratio, we said we can run something like 10 to 1 or 15 to 1 on our CPUs. That means for every physical CPU we have, we can do 10 or 15 virtual CPUs on our virtual platform, and everything will still run efficiently. Again, the hypervisor is going to do the exchange between the virtual CPUs and the physical CPUs. And take care of that for us. When we go to design our virtual machines, we want to take a minimalist approach. So when we go to buy physical hardware, generally we'd try to buy the top of the line. We want to buy those i7s. We want to buy eight core CPUs to make sure that we have that. However, when we go to create our virtual machines, we usually want to start with the minimalist approach and start with one or two CPUs and see how our machine does. Again, within the hypervisor, we're going to be able to look at our matrices and we're going to be able to see, is it utilizing all of the CPU that we've given it? Do we need to give it more CPU? And it's a lot easier to give CPU to those machines than it is to take it away. So if we start out with one core and we see that it's always at 90%, then we can go in and add that second core and the machine will be able to handle that properly. However, if we start out with four cores and we see that it's only using 1%, when we try to take those cores away, the guest operating systems usually have more of a fit to say about that. In terms of virtual CPUs in our virtual environment, we have very little that we can do. Usually, we can only specify the amount. And again, when we go to specify the amount of virtual CPUs, it will give us that option to specify the number of sockets and the number of cores. So if we want to allocate three CPUs to it, the only way that we can really allocate three CPUs to it is to have one socket and three cores. If we have two sockets, then we have to allocate in powers of two. So again, if we have two sockets, then we can allocate one core, that would be two. If we allocate two cores, that's going to be four. So again, we can't get that three without just using a single socket. So just be aware of that as well. Virtual memory, again, memory is going to be mapped to the physical memory. It's going to be managed by the hypervisor. A VM is only going to be able to see and utilize the amount of memory that's been allocated. In terms of VMware allows you to allocate specific amounts of memory. Again, it's not going to use everything that you allocate to it. It's going to share it between the entire virtualized environment. So if you say 16 gigs and it's only using two, you still have those 14 available. But again, it's best to take that minimalized approach. If you talk specific applications that run on a virtual platform, such as an email server or an SQL server, they're going to go in and take up memory. So SQL by default takes up 80% of whatever RAM you give it in a system. So if you give it 10 gigabytes of RAM, it's going to take up 80% of it. You give it 20 gigabytes of RAM, it's going to take up 80% of that RAM. So we're not going to get a clear picture of the actual amount that's being utilized in our system through SQL. So we have to be careful of that. Again, it's best to take that minimalized approach, watch our maps and see if it's utilizing all of its memory consistently. If so, then we can add more memory in. Microsoft Hyper-V actually allows you to assign RAM dynamically, so you can specify that it starts with maybe 512 megabytes of RAM, and then as it needs it, it allows it to take whatever it needs. In performance, I really haven't seen too much of a difference from allocating that memory and allowing it to grab it dynamically, but only time will tell on how well it works. We will talk later about our specific tools that we install, VMware tools specifically, to help us manage the memory more optimally and give us more features. But again, in terms of virtual memory, the most we can do is really assign how much RAM our computers have. When you look at assigning RAM to, you got to be careful what it's asking for. If it's asking for megabytes, you can't do that simple 1,000 megabytes equals a gigabyte. It's 1024. So just be aware of that as well. And again, I mentioned this before, virtual memory is the resource that most systems run out of first. So if you think about a normal system may have something like four cores in its CPU, but then it's going to have something like 32 gigabytes of RAM. So 32 compared to the four, of course, it's going to want more of that, more of that. So we put in as much RAM as we can into our host VMware system or our host Hyper-V systems. And then our virtual machines are going to contention over that resource above all else. In terms of virtual networking is how our virtual machines are going to communicate to the outside world. For those of you who have taken Introduction to Networking or Advanced Networking, we've talked a lot about VLANs and how VLANs segregate out networks. VLANs become especially important within our virtual networking environment. And when we get to the chapter on virtual networking, we'll kind of deep dive into some of that. For those of you who haven't taken the Introduction to Networking course or haven't gotten to that point in that course, worry not. We'll take our time. We'll go over it in detail and what we need to know. It won't cover everything that's covered in Introduction to Networking, but you'll hopefully have a good sense of what a VLAN is and how VLANs work and make it easier for you to understand it there. Again, if you've already taken it there, hopefully this will further your understanding of it as well. We try to blend everything together so that you get the big picture. But again, in terms of our physical hypervisor, our hypervisor is going to have physical networking ports that are going to connect to our switch. The way that we connect them to our switch is going to dictate how we can feed them into our virtual machines. Typically, our VM hosts will have more than one network interface card. Typically, those cards will have more than one port on them. It's not abnormal to see network interface cards on a virtualized host with four ports to actually plug network interface lines into, and it's not abnormal to actually see two of those four port cards. So again, eight network interfaces. Again, network bandwidth is kind of more in contention now. How fast you want to access your data becomes very important. How many virtual machines are you running on your machine? That's important. So from standpoint of a jobs perspective, there's two types of people generally who work in an IT environment. There's the systems administrators who are in charge of the operating systems, and then the network administrators who are in charge of the network. If you work for a large company, I worked for Time Warner Cable. Time Warner Cable divided those responsibilities out. So there was actually a team that dealt primarily with networking, and there was a team that dealt with the desktop and server environment. So if there was a problem with a server that was running in a virtualized environment, the systems administrator people would be in charge of taking care of that. But when you talk virtual networking and physical networking, there's kind of a disconnect there. So network engineers understand how routers work, they understand how switches work. But when you condense that into the virtual environment and you start talking virtual switching and virtualing environment, it starts to become kind of gray cloud. Is that a systems administrator job? It's part of the virtual environment. It's part of a virtual server. So technically, it's a server and not physical networking equipment. So it kind of falls into their realm. But again, systems administrators aren't usually specialized in the networking environment. Those are the network engineers. So again, this area becomes very kind of cloudy, and it is usually the area that's misconfigured the most. Again, there's other solutions that have presented themselves recently. So Cisco makes actually a virtual networking switch that works just like its physical switches, and allows network engineers to manipulate it as they would a physical switch and kind of understand it better in that regards. And again, systems administrators are starting to learn more of the networking environment and how they interact with the network engineers. So again, in large environments, it's split out. In smaller environments, you're in charge of both anyway. You just got to figure out where your problem lies. So again, I work for a municipality and there was four of us, so we wore all our hats. So one day I was the exchange administrator, the next day I was the Cisco network administrator, and I would have to troubleshoot problems from point A to point B. So again, it's good to be aware of all of it. It's good to have a good understanding of everything. Even in the event where the two jobs are broken out, you want to understand where you're sort of, I've checked everything that I can do now. I kind of suspect that it's in your realm. We also talked virtual storage. Again, we'll deep dive more on this in later chapters and the types of disks that we use and the RAID arrays and things of that nature. But when virtual storage is presented to the guest operating system, they're only going to see the amount of space that we allocate to it. So we may have a 40 terabyte SAN on our back end, but if we only give 80 gigabytes of hard disk space to our virtual machine, the virtual machine's only going to see that 80 gigabits of space. And again, later on, we'll talk about some other things that we can do. We can do thick disk provisioning and thin disk provisioning. Again, allocating that space fully up front or saying, hey, you can take this much space, but you're only going to use what you're actually going to use right up front, and do some sort of magic in the background to get everything to play nice and to allow us to use more resources than we physically have. So how do our virtual machines work? So again, we have our virtual machine hardware. On top of our virtual machine hardware, we're going to install guest operating systems, and then the guest operating systems will have applications on top of those. So the applications are going to talk to the guest operating system. The guest operating system is going to talk to the virtual machine hardware. The virtual machine hardware is going to talk to the hypervisor, and the hypervisor is going to talk to our physical devices and write our virtual machine out to our disk space. So again, the hypervisor is going to control any interactions with the physical devices, manage all the transactions from the virtual hardware to the physical hardware. But the virtual machine is going to look and feel like it was an actual machine somewhere out there running its processes. Again, because of our properties of our virtual machine, it needs to think that it's a physical machine. So now that we've created one virtual machine in our virtual environment, how do we get multiple machines out there? So again, there's ways to deploy multiple virtual machines pretty quick and easy. The first way to do it is to clone it. So there's lots of different types of cloning software. And in top terms of cloning, if you want to clone a duplicate of a virtual machine, all you have to do is copy the file system. So if I have a virtual machine that's stored on a USB drive and I copy it to my hard drive, I've made a clone of that virtual machine. Clones duplicate the virtual hardware and all of the software that's installed on those machines. That's all well and great, but you have to be careful with clones, especially in a domain environment or an enterprise level environment. because clones actually copy all of the same system information, all the registry keys, all of the unique identifiers of system information. So Windows in particular, as part of an Active Directory domain, when you boot two systems that have the same identifiers, they act as the same machine, and that can cause a lot of problems in the system. So the ways around that is to actually change those identifiers. So Windows has built within it a system utility called sysprep that actually erases all the unique information from the machine and allows you to deploy copies of machines with all the software installed pretty quick and easy. Again, we'll talk more about that as we get further in the chapters, but just be aware that clones can cause issues. Another type of machine that we can create is called a template. A template is a non-running virtual machine that acts as a standard mold for all new VMs. So with the template, I'm going to go in, install all my software, do our Windows updates, turn it off, convert it into a template, and then I'm going to make copies of that template. When I make copies of the template, it's going to do all its unique customizations to make it a unique machine, but it's going to have all of the updates that I need. So templates are really important in a VDI or virtual desktop environment. They're also referred to as gold images. They're going to be the standard kind of boot image that everybody's going to use to create virtual machines from. In a VDI environment, we use a single template to push out all our virtual machines. So when we go to update our template in our VDI environment, we only need to update our gold image. And then the next time people turn off and restart their machine, they'll get all those updates. So it's, it becomes a management blessing. Instead of having to go out and touch all of the workstations in your environment or push out a WSUS server to actually go and download updates for all of those machines and make sure all those machines are getting their updates, you can update it just in a single spot, and then they can get it all from that update. The next thing that we talk about is snapshots. So snapshots really is a VMware term. The term for it in Microsoft is checkpoint, but effectively there's the same thing. It's a point in time capture state of the virtual machine that can be returned to over and over again. So if I go and I have my machine and my machine's running and then a new version of a software comes out, or it's Tuesday and I have to push out my Windows updates, what I can do is say snapshot. The snapshot goes out and it grabs all of the registries and all of the RAM and everything and stores it in one spot. From our virtual machine perspective, what it's doing is it actually puts a stop to writing that file in the virtual machine and creates a new virtual machine file that's going to store any changes from that point on. So what I'll do is I'll take a snapshot, then I'll go in and I'll stall my Windows updates, and it pooched my system. I can't boot to Windows anymore. After I install this update, nothing works. I don't like Windows 10. I want to go back to Windows 8. So I revert to my snapshot. In reverting to my snapshot, it undoes all that changes. Again, it's going to delete the second file that was created and just put my pointer back to my original file. And I have that machine back to that point in time. And again, it's very important that you do your snapshot before you make any changes, because after you make any changes, it's going to snapshot the changes that you've made. It's, again, a point-in-time capture. Those point-in-time captures also vary in usability. Again, if I'm on my email server, I could do a snapshot of my email server, install the updates. The updates work great. A week later, something breaks in my virtual machine. If I revert to my snapshot's a week old. So any email that was sent from that point that I did my snapshot to the point that I'm actually reverting is going to be lost. So again, the usefulness in some servers is not good. Again, if you have a machine that's always doing the same thing and basically it's used for login and people surf the internet, you can use snapshots and keep reverting to the same snapshot and just deleting anything that's running at time. An equivalent to that would be something like deep freeze, where it kind of stores the memory so they can't write to that. And again, these three things, clones, templates, snapshots, they all make virtual machines much easier to use than physical servers. Because again, with physical servers, you can clone it, but you're copying everything from disk to disk. Templating it is a little hard, but you can do that. Again, most of the software to do that is going to be virtual machine software. And snapshotting, Windows has tried to do it with a system restore, and it works with varying success. So the last part of this chapter, and again, something that you've dealt with the papers here, is the Open Virtualization Format or OVF format. So what happened with the OVF format is that a bunch of vendors, like VMware, Microsoft, DEC or DEC, all got together and discussed the improvements that could be made to the virtual environment to facilitate changes and push progress forward. So the analogy that I go back to constantly is the war between HD DVD and Blu-ray DVD. So Blu-ray obviously won out. You can still buy Blu-rays. Blu-ray is a popular format. Everybody uses Blu-ray. Nobody uses HD DVD. The format died out. Instead of having that competition between the HD format and the Blu-ray format, or in our case with Hyper-V, we're using VHD or virtual hard disk, and with VMware, we're using our VMDK files. Instead of trying to fight out, should it be VMDK or VHD? How should we store our formats? They decided to make a third format, an OVF format. Again, the OVF is the vendor neutral format. It allows vendors to create their virtual machines in this vendor-neutral format that all of the other vendors agreed to support. So VMware supports the OVF format. If you take an OVF format virtual machine and you try to bring it into your VMware environment, what VMware does is it reads that OVF file. And because OVF is standardized, it knows how to read any OVF format. And then what VMware does is convert from OVF to its VMDK file and then runs it as a VMDK file. In terms of Hyper-V, Hyper-V will read the OVF file and then convert it to its VHD file and then run it as a VHD file. So really, what does the OVF file buy? Well, if I'm a software vendor and I want to deploy my machines both in Hyper-V and in VMware, I don't have to write two separate application programs to be able to distribute to both of those vendors. Instead, I can write in my one format, and then the vendors are responsible for making sure that it's compatible with their systems. So again, as a software implementer, it saves me time and money to create my virtual machines and limits what I need to do to make it work with everybody else's system. And again, because OVF is standardized, it goes far beyond just Microsoft Hyper-V and VMware vSphere. You can do it within all the other virtual machine platforms as well. So again, OVF is very beneficial to software designers. Again, if we want to have more than one virtual machine deployed at a time, we don't need to have just an OVF format. We can also do OVA, which is the Open Virtual Application or Appliance format. And what that does is put all of our virtual machines into one file and allows us to store it that way. So with the creation of OVF, does that mean that all of our software vendors have gone and moved to this format? No. So a lot of software vendors will still write specific formats that work on specific platforms. Recently, I just downloaded the latest version of Kali Linux. So Kali Linux from the Kali distributors only comes in VMDK format. They formatted it so that it only works within the VMware environment. Why did they do this? They did this because it's easier to format a machine and get it to work properly in one specific hardware environment than it is to try to make it neutral and work across all environments. Even though the OVF format supports it, they want it to work efficiently within one environment, and they chose to support VMware. There's other companies out there that support Microsoft Hyper-V, and again, we'll only make VHD files, so you have to run that VMware converter to convert from a VHD file to a VMDK file. And again, it works with varying success. The machines weren't built to work on that environment, so it may or may not have performance issues. But again, once the vendors have distributed their format, they say we are supporting this format, and that's what we say will work best. So you have to kind of take it in stride. So again, remember, virtual machines are just containers that run on top of hypervisors. They're files that are stored on disk. Because they're just files stored on disk, they're much more flexible than physical servers. We can move them around, we can copy them, we can do all kinds of crazy things with them to get them to work efficiently. From a user application standpoint, they're going to look and act like physical servers. Again, if I have a client and that client logs into my server, they shouldn't be able to tell the difference between my virtual environment and my physical environment. VMwares are incredibly cost effective. Again, files on disk, so they cost as much as disk storage space. Disk storage space nowadays, very cheap. And lastly, the OVF, again, allows cross-platform, cross-vendor distribution of pre-built applications. So now that we've talked about what a virtual machine is, what do we need to do in order to create our virtual machines? So with Chapter 4, we're going to talk about P2V. We'll also talk about V2V and V2P conversions. The book actually goes through loading VMware Player, and for those of you who are listening at home, I definitely suggest that you download a Type 2 hypervisor and go through sort of the process of creating virtual environments and doing that on your own. You'll gain much more understanding of it by actually laying your hands on it and doing it. And then in the end, we're going to create a virtual machine. So when we talk P2V, P2V is actually physical to virtual. So we're taking a physical machine that exists somewhere in our system, and we're converting it to a virtual machine using the physical server as our template. So again, what a P2V does is it goes out, it scans the hardware, reads the hardware information, and then creates a virtual machine to match that hardware instance. So if I'm going to run a copy of my machine, and my machine is a quad-core processor with 32 gigabits of RAM, when I run the P2V process, it's going to allocate 4 vCPUs and 32 gigabits of virtual RAM in order to build that machine and load those machine's files. So again, earlier we talked about two different things. We talked about consolidation and containment. So consolidation, again, is going to be removing those physical servers from our data center by virtualizing them onto our physical host. And containment is going to be deploying new applications directly into our virtual environment. So as somebody who's been a systems administrator and done this process, I don't generally recommend the physical to virtual conversion process. Although it's the cheapest and easiest solution to do in terms of consolidation, going out, scanning existing servers, copying over all the information, and then creating a virtual machine in our virtual environment, generally it can cause issues. So if you're doing it because you're having issues with a physical server, your physical server's doing something funky, you don't know if it's hardware or software related, if you do a P2V, you're going to copy over some of those problems as well. If it is just aging hardware and your hardware is dying out, again, the P2V process can save it from that because you're moving it on to virtual hardware, so there's no physical hardware other than the host that's going to be operating. And again, enterprise level bosses tend to like the P2V process because they know there's nothing that you can change in the process. It's going to be an exact duplication of the existing system in your virtual environment. It's going to read everything in, it's going to emulate all that hardware information and put it in the virtual environment. Instead, what I recommend to everybody is to do a containment. So if you're converting, say, a domain controller from your physical environment to your virtual environment, instead of doing that P2V conversion of your domain controller, actually create a new virtual machine, set it up, brand new software, latest operating system, install all the patches, install all the software that you need, and migrate your clients from your physical machine to your virtual environment domain controller. Again, you'll have less problems. You'll know that you built it from scratch, so any issues that you have, you know what you've done, and you don't have to worry about any legacy things that are built into those machines. Again, you'll have people that will recommend the other process just as much. But you have to do either what you know is best or what your boss tells you to. There's two types of cloning that we can do. We can do hot cloning and cold cloning. Hot cloning creates a virtual machine while everything's active, so you're never going to take your machine offline. It's going to read everything while it's live and create a duplication of it. Again, at the end of a hot clone, you want to make sure that you're powering down your original machine. Otherwise, you're going to have two machines that are exactly identical running at the same time. Again, in an Active Directory domain environment, you're going to cause a lot of issues doing that. If you're cloning your email server, do I send to the physical server or do I send to the virtual server? Because they both look exactly identical. And that can cause a lot of problems. Cold cloning requires the application being active. Again, with an email server, it's always sending and receiving email. With backup servers, they're always sending and receiving information to their system. So you may have to turn them off. And when you turn them off and you clone them while they're off, that's cold cloning. And again, systems with databases, things that are active all the time, usually you do have to cold clone those. You can try doing the hot cloning process. Sometimes it will fail. If it consistently fails, I recommend doing the cold cloning. There's lots of different vendor tools and third-party tools to perform P2Vs, so physical to virtual. You also have virtual to virtual conversions. Again, are we converting from Hyper-V to VMware or from VMware to Hyper-V? So that would be a V2V or virtual to virtual conversion. But they also have the option to do virtual to physical. So if I'm writing software to run on a physical platform, I may write that software in a virtual environment. Again, it's a lot easier for me to open up my laptop and type on my laptop and create it in a virtual environment than it is for me to have a separate physical machine sitting on my desk that I'm going to operate on. So I'll do all my work in the virtual environment, and then when I'm in my final phase where I'm testing to make sure everything works out, I'm going to take my virtual machine and map it onto physical hardware. And then once it's on physical hardware, I can test and make sure that it works the way that I want it to. Again, there's lots of different tools out there. There's a couple of different tools on CM Connect that I had them play with in class. If you have the opportunity to play with those, I'd recommend those as well. There's the Microsoft Virtual Machine Conversion Software, MVMC, and there's also the VMware Standalone Converter. Both of them have kind of different requirements. The VMware Standalone Converter tends to work a lot more efficiently than the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. The Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter is kind of their free tool. There's a systems tool that works better, but you have to have a domain set up and you have to have some other things configured, which we don't have in our lab here, and also create much more of an overhead in our system than is really needed for what we're going to get out of it for our class. But give those tools a try and see how well they work for you if you have a chance. So again, I mentioned that the book goes through using VMware Player. VMware Player is a Type 2 hypervisor. VMware Player is free. VMware Workstation is the paid version of VMware Player. It offers some more features. Fusion is the Macintosh version of VMware Workstation. Parallels Desktop is also out there. VirtualBox or VBox is out there as a free version. Microsoft Windows Virtual PC is out there as well. So again, there's lots of different Type 2 hypervisors that allow you to create, manage, and run virtual machines. And I definitely recommend that you play with one, you play with a couple. I'm a VMware person by nature. I have a lot of VMware training, so tended to stick with VMware for a while. But VirtualBox I find works a lot easier than VMware, but it is limited in some of the options that you have. So when you go to create a new machine, what we do first is build the hardware. Again, we're going to define what CPU it has, what RAM it has, and then we're going to add the operating system to it later. So you'll see within the options of our virtual machine, it will ask you what type of virtual machine that you want to have on it, and what types of things that it has. So when we go to build a virtual machine again, and this is in VMware Player, it wants to know how much disk space that we have. Do we want to store it in a single file? Do we want to split it across multiple files? Again, if we're keeping it all in one place, we may want it in multiple files. We may want it in a single file. If we're transporting it from one system to another, it's easier to do in a single file. You do have to be careful with single files. Again, there's limitations within the operating system of 2 terabytes in size. So if you have a virtual machine that's going to be larger than 2 terabytes, you have to have it in more than one file. So just be aware of that. Again, it's going to ask us how much memory we want to allocate to it, how many processors. Again, we want to make sure that we're doing a minimalist approach when we create our virtual machines. Don't automatically allocate 60 gigs of RAM and 16 processors. Again, operating systems are going to have a maximum that they support as well as a minimum of requirements that they support. And VMware and some of our other tools let us know what those minimum and maximum amounts are. So they'll show us, based on the operating system that we choose to install, how much RAM we need minimum, how much it recommends, and how much the maximum it supports is. And again, that's going to be different between 32-bit versions of software and 64-bit versions of software, and of course our desktop Windows versus our server Windows. So again, P2V or physical to virtual conversions are going to be rapid and automated for moving from our physical servers into our virtual environments. Again, I recommend that you be careful using those P2V conversions in terms of what you're doing and why you're doing it. So be aware of that. And again, this chapter also talked about VMware Player as a Type 2 hypervisor. Again, I definitely recommend going out and grabbing any Type 2 hypervisor and playing with it. Optimally, if you have time, grab more than one, see the differences between them and what options that you have, and then go through the process of creating the virtual machine. So the next couple chapters that we deal with are actually going to show us how to install Windows and install Linux on our virtual machines. So we'll deal with that next class. Thanks, and have a great day.